The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
Thursday, welcome back. Another day, and we are ready to bring you 3 hours of radio tonight. First up is Dr. Henry Nyman. We do not have much to report in terms of out-of-control epidemic or pandemic viruses or other diseases, at least in the traditional sense. What we do have, though, is a proliferation of unusual diseases that shouldn't be here. Polio, tetanus, mumps, and things are being brought in by refugees to Europe, to the U.S. We're seeing things that we don't usually see. The question is, will they be able to be contained or will they get out of control? I don't know the answer to that. That's not what we're going to talk with about Henry, but just welcome back, Henry, and a quick comment about some of these unusual diseases we are seeing, and they are actually being reported here and certainly in a wide way across Europe.
Jeff, good to be back. As far as the diseases, as you say, they're coming in from other countries, so they're not new diseases, and they're all pretty containable type things. I mean, like, you know, you mentioned polio. There was a polio vaccine that pretty well knocked out the virus, and it's just kind of persisting in areas where they don't really, they retaliate about people giving against people giving the vaccines,
right?
Kind
right,
of
right.
Create the disease, and it's kind of created through kind of backwards thinking on what a vaccine does and what its utility is, and a suspicion of doctors or governments giving a vaccine, and so some of these diseases kind of shouldn't be anywhere in the world, and so because of that type of approach, kind of anti-science kind of approach that kind of allows viruses to exist that have essentially been eliminated from most of the world, and that's one example of that. But what I want to talk about tonight was really more on DNA testing. I talked about that a few times, and that's kind of proliferating, if you will, to a degree, and I think that's more an example of things for the future that it will expand, not because they're illegally coming into the country or sprouting up at different locations. They're kind of expanding because the ability to generate sequences or at least single nucleotide polymorphisms, which is what this testing is, has accelerated. So the cost has gone down dramatically. And, you know, it wasn't that long ago where the human genome was sequenced, and that, you know, caused billions of dollars.
Right.
And, and now you can basically, order a kit online, pay your $99, or sometimes it's as little as $50, and you get a little package in the mail. You just have to spit in the tube and put it in the addressed envelope, and in 6 weeks or so, you'll actually have about 600,000 tests done for $99.
So what kinds of things will you learn, Henry, with these tests? What are you going to get back?
That's what the interesting point of these kits are, and that's one of the reasons I wanted to talk about it a little bit, is the general public doesn't really have a very good appreciation on what these kits can do. And unfortunately, doctors don't have that much information on it either, and that's why I say it's kind of cutting edge. It's new technology, and there's a lot of education to be done. Right now, these kits are largely marketed as determining ancestry or genealogy. And
But that's just putting your foot on the threshold. These are going to go a long way beyond that.
Right, and that's what I was trying to get to. I had mentioned before that the two kits that I've had experience with has been 23andMe and Ancestry. The last month or so, I've looked a little bit more as to what's out there. There's a couple other popular kits. One's called Family Tree DNA. That's affiliated with the National Geographic. And then there's another one that's called MyHeritage. And there's actually another one in China that's called WeGene. And all of these kits have a lot in common. And, I'll talk a little bit more about the 23andMe and the Ancestry, because I've actually done testing with both of those and have data from myself and many family members and other people that have actually sent me results.
Well, okay, how many different kinds of things can be read by a gene test like this? And what are the people getting back? Like hundreds of things? Yes, no, yes, no, yes, yes, yes. How does it read? What's it like?
I'll go through it. You basically get, which most people don't even realize they get it, but you get you do get a raw data file. And the raw data file actually gives the results of these 600,000 tests. So you actually get 600,000 test results. And these tests they're called SNPs, or single nucleotide polymorphisms. And these are tests that look at a particular position in a particular gene on a particular chromosome. And then it's assigned a name. You know, it's mostly a number. It's not much of a name. It's a letter or two and six or seven numbers after that. Mm-hmm. And these SNPs, have been studied. They're in database. I mean, you go to GeneBank. GeneBank has a SNP section, and they're all there. The more popular ones, you can actually just Google them and get information. So each of these tests has a unique number. And the companies are using similar panels. They're not all exactly the same. I've done side-by-side comparisons of 23andMe and Ancestry. And these are different markers that have been identified by scientists as having various correlations with increased risk for various diseases, largely. I mean, when I looked at 23andMe, which was the first test that I actually got back, I was interested in cancer markers. The two most famous cancer markers are BRCA1 and BRCA2, which is breast, BR is for breast, and CA is for cancer. And so these are two genes that were kind of in the forefront of identifying risks that are associated with, or not risk, but changes, genetic changes that are associated with an increased risk. And in this case, most of the risk has been identified at this time for those two are actually for breast or ovarian cancer.
Okay, and, may I ask a question? This is important. I don't want anybody to get left behind here. I'm being left behind, sort of. Not your fault. I'm just trying to follow this. What we have then are genes. Now, when we're born, the general consensus, I think, of reflexive thought is that your genes are your genes are your genes. And I think I just heard you say that these genes can somehow morph or change and begin to demonstrate a proclivity or a possible leaning toward developing breast or ovarian cancer. In other words, the genes have changed. Is that a fact?
No, not. So let me go into a little bit more detail and give you an idea of what is actually being measured. If you, for instance, like I mentioned, breast cancer, BRCA1 and BRCA2, if you actually looked at the tumor itself and looked at what genes were there, there you might actually see some changes that happened. But in general, what is being measured in these tests is, in fact, what you were born with.
Your baseline genes. Okay. Yeah.
Your baseline genes. And what typically happens is, they're called single nucleotide polymorphisms because these are particular positions that vary in the general population. So, you might have most of the population has a T at a given position, and a small population out there has an A at that position. And then that genetic change in the DNA frequently will lead to a change in the protein, and that will affect the protein function. And having that mutation in the protein can leave you susceptible to disease. And just to use the BRCA1 and BRCA2 as examples, both of those genes are involved with identifying mistakes that happen during recombination. So, it's not a surprise that I ended up talking about sequences and the story in the sequence and recombination. So BRCA1 and BRCA2 are kind of proofreaders that if you make a mistake, they kind of go and clean up that mistake. And if you have a serious defect in that gene, and one example of that is what's called a frameshift mutation. And just to give you an idea how that works, with the genes, you kind of start with your DNA as what you inherit, and then for the DNA to kind of function, you go and you make a copy of it. It's called RNA, and then you basically use little codons, three letters, make a codon. So groups of three will direct exactly what the sequence is on the protein, and then the protein, basically its function is determined by what each of those individual positions are. And since the codon is three letters, if you take a stretch of that DNA, you can, just on the one strand, you can get three different reading frames. One would start with position one, so the 1, 2, 3 would be one codon, and 4, 5, 6 would be the next one, and 7, 8, 9 would be the next one. But you can also start at position two, so 2, 3, 4 would be 1, 5, 6, 7. So that would be a different reading frame, and then you could start at the third position, 3, 4, 5. So just on the one strand, reading that DNA, since they're done three at a time, they're called triplets or codons, you can really make three different proteins from that, depending upon whether you start at position one, two, or three. And there's these changes in the BRCA1 and BRCA2 that I was mentioning that were among the some of the first ones that were identified and associated with certain populations. They all were frameshift mutations. So what would happen is one of the positions of the DNA, they would actually lose one of the letters, or they would gain one of the letters, or they lose two of the letters. They would basically add or lose letters that were not divisible by three, and as a result, you would end up changing the reading frame. So, you know, the example I gave, if you started with one, and you would normally go 1, 2, 3 would be the first one, and 4, 5, 6 would be the next one. If you went, you lost the letter of position 4, well, then all of a sudden, if you started reading it, it wouldn't be one, you know, the second codon wouldn't be 4, 5, 6 anymore. It'd be 4, 5, 7 because 6 is gone. And then the next one would be 8, 9, 10, which would actually correspond to that second reading frame. And so you would start reading in the next reading frame. And the way evolution works is through selection, you kind of have an open reading frame where if you start at a given position, you can run through and go, you know, 100 or 1,000 positions without ever getting a stop codon, even though stops are fairly common. There's 64 different combinations if you're doing three at a time and there's four different letters. It's just four cute. So there's 64 different combinations, and three of them are stop codons. So if it's random, you know, every 15 to 20 positions, you're going to come up with a stop codon, and that's going to really kill the protein. It's not going to make anymore. It's going to stop. And so if you have one of these frames, that's typically what happens. You go into a reading frame that hasn't been selected, and all of a sudden, you know, 15 to 20 positions later, you hit a stop codon, and that's the end of the protein as far as how many positions it has. And so if that frameshift happens, you know, anywhere in the beginning or the middle of that sequence, you'll end up, you'll switch reading frames so the protein will start to pick up the wrong amino acids. And then before very long, it'll run into a stop codon, and it'll be truncated, it'll be short. And essentially, that protein won't be functional because it's not just one position change. You've got like 10 or 15 positions that changed, and then it stopped. And so it's way shorter than it's supposed to be, and it doesn't have the right amino acids in it. And that's essentially what these famous mutations are with BRCA1 and BRCA2. That BRCA1 really has two of these that have been identified in a certain population. These were initially identified in Ashkenazi Jewish populations, and those were populations that it was known there was a high rate of breast cancer and ovarian cancer. Mm-hmm. And so studies were done on the DNA of these populations to find out what correlated with the breast cancer. So they basically looked at the women that got breast cancer and compared their DNA to the women that didn't get breast cancer. They ended up finding these three different frameshifts, two of them in BRCA1 and one of them in BRCA2. You know, the women in general only had one of those three, but that essentially killed one or the other of those proteins. And that created this high incidence of breast cancer or ovarian cancer because they lost that proofreading function. So So in general, they only had one bad copy. So they had one good copy and they had one bad copy. So they still were able to do proofreading to a degree, but not as well as they should of having two good proteins doing the proofreading. They had one good one and one bad one. But unfortunately, what would tend to happen is, number one, the one good one didn't do quite as well as having two good ones. But during their lifetime, as the genetic information got copied, there is the possibility of more recombination. And during that recombination, you can actually convert the gene. So you can have, you can take your one good gene and start copying it. And then the machinery to kind of hop off and go on to the other chromosome. Remember, you've got two copies of each chromosome, one from your father and one from your mother. And so if you've got one good one and one bad one, you can have a situation where you start copying the good one, and then you hop over to the bad one, and then you go back to the good one, and all of a sudden you that copy is bad, and the other one is bad, and you end up with two bad ones. And that's called, I think I mentioned this before, loss of heterozygosity. So that's, instead of having one good and one bad, you don't have a heterogeneous combination. You've got a homogeneous combination. You've got two bad. And when you get to that level, then you don't really have the ability to kind of clean up these mistakes. The mistakes start to accumulate. It leads to cancer. The cancer is kind of growing out of control. The ones with the two mistakes get selected, and the host ends up with breast or ovarian cancer. And so, unfortunately, this kind of effect doesn't happen when they're born. It basically happens. I mean, there is a tendency to have breast cancer at an early age, but the early age is kind of in the 30s or 40s, where most women that get breast cancer, it's usually postmenopausal, and they're in their 60s or 70s or so. So these women get breast cancer early, but they don't get breast cancer before they reach childbearing age. And so they tend to pass that genetic information on to their children, and then the mothers end up getting breast cancer, and they either recover or they don't recover. But in the meantime, the gene, one bad copy, one good copy situation gets passed on, and then their children end up being carriers of this, and then that leads to the same defect showing up generation after generation. And that's kind of what these tests can do. They can basically take a look at your DNA, and this is an example. They can go and say, oh, you've got a frame shift in BRCA1. So you're probably going to, your chance of getting breast cancer.
Okay, I get it. I get it now.
It's significantly higher than the general population.
I got it. Okay. All right. Hold on. We have to take a break. I got it now. All right. We'll be right back. This 23andMe is awfully cutesy, and I'm wondering about this database collecting and how many people are going to jump into it. Now, how happy that might make the government to have voluntary genetic data on most everybody. I think we know the answer to that. Be right back. Okay, and back with Henry. All right, let me ask you this. What's the future of this, Henry? This is, talk about the ultimate invasive data on people, right?
Well, yes and no. Just to clarify, this testing I'm describing actually is not being done by the government. This is actually private.
I know
company.
It's private enterprise. Yeah.
And at least on paper, I mean, you can make speculations as to what happens with the data. You can make the same speculations about what happens with your medical data. But on paper, this is private information, and they do not have a legal right to distribute the information, to distribute the sequences or the SNPs, if you will, or the raw DNA file. You also have options when you sign up for it. You don't have to use your name. You can, they used to let you do anonymous. Now they make you put some type of initials on it. And then as far as who can see what, there are permissions on that also as to whether they can kind of compare it. You know, your DNA to their DNA or things along those lines. And so you're not just kind of saying, well, I'm going to do this test and everybody in the world can see it, or any government agency can see it, or anybody other than me can see it. In fact, when I got the initial results on 23andMe, there were some anomalies, and I did call them and talk to them.
We knew you were different, Henry. We knew you were different all the time.
And I told him, well, you know, I mean, basically, it was pretty dramatic data. It basically indicated that I was actually looking at the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes. Those were the two I was most interested in, and they have those are probably the two most studied by 23andMe and Ancestry, where they literally had, I think Ancestry had almost 2,000 SNPs for each one of them, and 23andMe, I think, had 600 or 700 SNPs in them. And I had all these frame shift mutations, and I called them and said, you know, this just is not credible that you could have. I think I had 8 frame shifts in one and 6 frame shifts in the other. And I said, you know, there's no way that, you know, I shouldn't be alive if I really had that many frame shifts in both BRCA1 and BRCA2.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I was explaining the data that, because I was looking at the, they actually allow you to query each gene, and it's fairly easy. I mean, you can just search your raw DNA, and you can put in BRCA1, and they'll give you all the SNPs for that gene, and they'll give the results. I mean, basically, what you get is you get what the sequence is on each of the two chromosomes, and again, it's very easy with this frame shift type thing. That if you have X number of letters on one chromosome and Y on the other, and they're different, and the difference isn't divisible by 3, then that's automatically a frame shift. And so, you know, there's all these frame shifts. There's no data in the literature of individuals having you know, multiple frame shifts in a given gene and to have it in both. And I said to him, yeah, you can just go ahead and look at my sequence. And they said, well, we're not allowed to look at your sequence. You know, we basically, that's private. We can't view your sequence. And I ended up sending them screenshots of the examples that I had. And they did say they were going to, not use those SNPs in the future because there seems to be a problem. And so they did concede that you couldn't have that many. And, the interesting part was that they were not able to look at an individual's sequence, much less, sell them or get them out.
All right. Well, that's fine. Okay. I don't know where it's going to go eventually, but all right. Now, but I have another question. You sure. Come back and it's the BRCA1, BRCA2 things look a little dicey. Well, how do you prevent breast and ovarian cancer, Henry? Well, the average person eats poison, toxic American food. which is loaded with chemicals that can trigger all kinds of anomalies in the body at the cellular level. We know that. So what do you do? What do you do with somebody? Oh, you got bad BRCA 1, bad BRCA 2. You got to become a vegan right away or you're going to die.
Well, I mean, you've already got the mutation. It doesn't matter, you know, what you eat as far as getting any more. You were born with it. So it's already a problem.
I think we have an epidemic of breast cancer, and I would suggest that maybe it isn't something we're all born with. We know that toxic materials agglutinate and accumulate in the breast, and they become concentrated.
Well, like I said, the testing that I'm talking about is not coming from the tumor.
That's the baseline.
The DNA that you're born with.
Okay? I gotcha.
And BRCA 1 and BRCA 2, like I said, are two very famous predisposing mutations. But as it turns out, most people, and even most people in the targeted population, most people with breast cancer don't have these changes and these three positions in these two genes. It's like 1 or 2% of the population have it. So 98% don't have those changes. And they still get breast cancer. But as it turns out, there was a, BRCA 1 and BRCA 2 are two examples that do this, proofreading of these mistakes that show up during recombination, but they interact with other proteins and which are encoded by other genes. And so you can basically have the same effect by affecting another gene that's, involved in that complex that goes and cleans up these types of mistakes. And a study was recently published on looking at what was in the breast cancer tumors themselves. And these mistakes that show up that don't get corrected are kind of like a signature that there's a problem in this proofreading pathway, and that the proofreading really is not really functioning at the level that it's supposed to, and you're getting these characteristic changes in your DNA that indicates that the proofreading, the recombination mistakes aren't getting cleaned up. And that was actually found in 20% of breast cancer cases in the United States. And so that indicated that even if you didn't have the mistake in BRCA 1 or BRCA 2, you likely had an error in another protein that was involved in that complex in general, or in that pathway. And you end up with this this type of a signature that indicates that the BRCA1/BRCA2 pathway is not really functioning properly. So that's evidence that, it happens at a fairly high frequency, and that's just one, type of error. And so like I said, with the with this testing, you literally get 600,000 test results, and they cover a lot of different genes, and they don't just cover breast cancer. Another popular one is well-known one is for Alzheimer's disease, late onset Alzheimer's, and this is in a gene called APOE is what the APOE I should say. If you have that, if you have one bad copy of that, you have about a threefold increase in the likelihood of getting Alzheimer's, getting early onset Alzheimer's. And if you have two bad copies, it's 10 to 20-fold increase. And so that, in that case, it's not even a frame shift. It's just a single change that changes a single position in the protein, but that's enough to increase your risk by those significant levels. And that's covered in these tests also. And, you know, there's an interesting history behind that one, that it turns out that measuring that mistake directly is somewhat difficult. And this testing used to, anyway, give false negatives. So even though you had the defect and you had the risk, it said it looks normal, you know, on the chip. And as it turned out, that's on chromosome 19, and it was found that there are several additional positions nearby in adjacent genes on chromosome 19, and they correlate with that. And so, typically, if you do have an increased risk, you don't just have that one change; you really have five different changes. They had one of those changes as a surrogate. They would basically use that one, and they would ignore the one they had a problem with, and they would look at the other one and say, well, you've got that, you probably have it. They cleaned it up, so they actually have that FDA approved, and they do a direct test now. But that's just one of the examples on of the 600,000 test results that you get. And
600,000 test results. You know how many years it would take me to read that?
You can get it done in about 1 minute online for $5.
No, so, I mean reading 600,000 test results.
That's what I'm talking about.
Well, I know the test can read them, but how am I going to read them?
That's what I just said, that it's done by your computer, or it's done by their computer. Basically,
well, I'm going to send it to you, and you can do it. All right.
Here's the deal. There's a service that's called Prometheus, and for $5, they'll take your raw DNA file and just to go through the mechanics of this. When you get the test results, like I said, there are these different markers that are included in the 600,000 test results.
Uh-huh.
The companies that are offering this are not advertising these tests as medical applications. They're simply advertising them as genealogy, and they're using these markers kind of as a dual purpose, even though most of the markers they test for have been, you know, examined for associations with different types of pathologies. They also segregate with different genetic backgrounds or different genetic groups. And so, you know, if you see the ancestry advertisement, you know, I took my test, I had no idea I had X, Y, and Z in my background, and I got the results back, I'm 20% of this, and I thought I was, you know, almost all that, you know, and that's really based on the same 600,000 tests, but they know that certain tests kind of correlate with different groups, and so they can basically take that profile and give you what your ancestry is.
Right.
That's the type of information they give you when mm-hmm. when you actually do the test. But mm-hmm. like I say, there is a raw DNA, and especially for 23andMe, you can search that raw DNA, and so you can. I mean, for instance, you can type in BRCA1, and you won't get 600,000 test results. You'll get 600 test results. And so they'll give you a list of the 600 markers in the BRCA1 gene that they tested,
mm-hmm.
and they'll tell you what each of your two alleles. They'll give you two results for each position, what you got from your mother and what you got from your father. Although they won't define them as mother, father, they'll just give you the two letters. And then, you know, you can go and there's a, like I say, there is a database at GeneBank that really has these SNPs and what kind of associations they have based upon what types of tests various researchers found and published, and then they're in GeneBank. And then there's another website that's called a SNPedia. So it's SNPedia. And so they basically have these markers that that are in Gene Bank, and they give an explanation, and they say, this particular marker has a threefold increase if you have one copy, and a tenfold increase if you got two copies, and the test was done in this population, and it involved this many people, and this is what. This is where that data came from, and you can go and read the studies and find out exactly what SNPs they looked at and what kind of correlations they had, and so this one company, Prometheus, will basically take your raw DNA, so you basically can download it from one of the companies that make generate the results. It's a zip file. When you download it, it's like 5 megs. Takes, depends on your computer, but it takes like less than a minute to get it onto your computer. So then you've got your raw DNA file, and you go to Prometheus and say, you just type it in, what your email address is, and you upload that data from your computer to their site, and they make sure that it really is a raw DNA file, and they say, do you want a report? Give us a credit card, and we'll charge you $5. And
are you sure, Henry, this isn't...
It takes about maybe 5 minutes. Uh-huh. And you'll get a full report on everything that was in your raw DNA that was covered in Snippopedia, and it'll have a little report, and it'll tell you what each of those changes, what risk is associated with that. And so you can get that readout pretty quickly. It'll take you a little while to go through the report, but the report is searchable. And so you can basically, ask about prostate markers, and they'll give you all the results that have to do with risks for prostate cancer, and you can see how many of they have.
I think it's a communist conspiracy, Henry. I really do. This is an intrigue. It's a plot. I'm 23 and me. No, 23 and thee. How's that?
You can pick the company. They'll do this type of.
I'm kidding you. I'm just having fun here. I'm just having fun.
Right, but I'm saying you can do ancestry. You can pick your name.
Right.
But the bottom line is that.
Geez, we might be related, Henry. You never know. You go back far enough, and there's just two people, weren't there?
Well, I was going to tell you some of the things that you can do with this, and that actually was one of the projects I'm working on. That basically, when I got my results, it turns out that I'm actually a distant cousin of my wife. So
I think that should be reported immediately to some authority somewhere.
So it was just to give you an idea, it wasn't very close. I mean, basically, the 23andMe, when they get to the distant relative level, they go down to about 0.8% of identity on the DNA. And we weren't at 0.8, we were like at 0.1. So we were quite a bit below the cutoff where they even reported them. But as it turned out, because I'm pretty sure because we were both on the same account and we both had the same last name, they went and they gave us that, they put each of us on each other's distant relative, and that actually makes it very convenient for doing doing an analysis at 23andMe, because you can take your sequence, take a relative, and then run that against all of your other relatives to see who is related to both of you. And when you do that, we found a lot of people that were in fact related to both of us, and they were much more related than we were to each other. And so that's one of my little projects, is to find out exactly, trace back, where this relationship develops. And
hope this doesn't mean divorce or anything like that.
I mean, the kids might be more interested than the parents, but in any event.
You know what? Here's another one for you. Now, listen to this. Here, this is interesting. You can go through any urban area in this country and pick 8 people. And in those 8 people, random people, you will find sooner or later a link with somebody you know or have come into contact with. And this is like 20 years ago. That's how mobile this is now, because of the internet, it's probably down to 4 or 5 random people before you find a link, some contact link, some kind.
Well, in this case, you can find a genetic link. And, that's what I was going to get to a little bit on how these are developing. And just briefly.
Well, we got just 1 minute. We have to do this real quick or next time.
So. Right. Right. So they'll let you look at DNA relatives. So they'll take your DNA and they'll look at everybody in their database, and they'll go ahead and give you your best match and what percentage it is, and that'll tell you approximately what the relationship is. And so there is a lot going on in that arena is doing comparisons, and then some of the sites are actually allowing you for free actually to upload your data to their database, because different relatives use different services, and then there's one that'll accept them from everybody's, and it's called GEDmatch, GED Match, and that one's very user friendly. So this is all very doable to find out, who's out there. We found quite a few relatives that had.
Did you find them down at the Walmart around the corner? What do you mean you found them in the phone book?
Well, they're DNA matches, so they say who they are, and we know how close they are, and based upon how close they are, we know where they should fall out on a genealogical tree, and a lot of these people that do this do have genealogical trees, and you can basically find them, or you can basically come to the conclusion that even though we can't say for sure, your great-grandfather and my great-grandfather were brothers.
You're saying that my relatives fell out of the trees? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, the relatives are in the trees. There's a lot of trees out there, and a lot of they're actually pretty large.
I see.
So this genealogical kind of stuff is very doable, as well as doing your own type of analysis for markers associated with disease.
Well, very interesting, Henry. No one else has ever done this on radio before. I'm convinced you've done it wonderfully. Maybe we'll do part 2 next time, huh? We'll see.
Okay, sounds good.
Thank you, my friend.
Okay, talk to you soon.
Take care. Right. Well, never heard an hour like that before. All right, we'll be back.